Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture,
comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends,
pop.
This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Our guest was the star of movies like To Jillian on her 37th birthday, I Know What You Did Last Summer, She's All That, and Scooby-Doo. He's also been a writer-director for Vince McMahon's WWE. He's a prolific voice actor on animated series like Star Wars Rebels, and he is currently a major star on Twitch, along with making regular appearances on ESPN LA, including filling in for John Ireland on a regular basis. Freddie Prinze Jr. is here. Hey, Freddie.
You left out so much stuff.
I know. You've got a lot more. Your Wikipedia page is very crowded, man.
I'm sure it's all factual, too.
So first off, what'd you do to your... You're wearing a walking boot. What'd you do?
I don't have any more ligaments connecting my ankle to my foot. I was moving furniture. And took the third stair, thought it was the second stair.
Yep.
And it kind of rolled sideways, and I heard it go pop, 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 pop.
Oh, no.
And it didn't hurt for a second, so I was like, all right, I think my ankle just like dislocated and went back in. And then it really hurt. And then thank God my housekeeper heard the crash and came up, and she was like, are you okay, Freddie? I was like, no, not at all. I got to call the hospital and I need ice now. So it was killer. But I've been taking these crazy laser treatments and I don't know how it works. And I'm not trying to debunk it or bunk it, I guess would be the opposite. But I'm telling you, in less than 48 hours, I was off crutches.
So what are the laser treatments?
It's the laser they shoot you with, bro. Yeah. I told you, I don't know how it works. It's a laser.
Where do you even find something like that?
They're all over. I went to the one on Wilshire, the Pacific Sports Medicine.
Yeah.
There's another one in Malibu, and it worked for me. But yeah, they shoot you with a laser gun, man. Boom.
See, I was hoping it was going to be some martial arts thing.
Nah, I wish it was like there were these three guys at Santa Monica Pier, right? And I knew they looked shady, so I just went in. I don't have time for the social media backlash. And turns out they had a bomb on their chest. First guy caught me with a sidekick. I was like, ah. I spun around. Bang. Then the third guy popped my ankle. I was like, ah. And I knew it was hurt, but I fought through it. See, that story could go on a long time.
I would go with that for sure.
Yeah, really. I would too.
I just fell downstairs.
What were you carrying?
A shelf with stuff in it.
Well, yeah, maybe.
But I didn't drop any of the stuff. Pro.
So, but you are into martial arts.
Well, I've lived a very...
By the way, I know very little about you, despite the fact that we've worked together
for a long time. We only have time to talk about Lakers and Rams.
It's so true.
And we get like 3 minutes to really get to know each other between segments. Like, that doesn't work. So, but this is something I love talking about. My father was a stand-up comic, and he met this dude, because Muhammad Ali used to beat him up all the time, not joking, and he met this dude that he wanted to teach him how to fight named Bob Wall. And Bob Wall was the guy who started teaching and learning from Bruce Lee when Bruce came to America. His best friend was Chuck Norris. He was a legit dude. He taught Steve McQueen how to fight, James Garner, all the old school tough guys that weren't tough. He taught them how to fight so they looked like they knew what they were doing. So he is in the Black Belt Hall of the Martial Arts Hall of Fame in Nevada. Bob Wall, look him up. He's the guy Bruce Lee beat up in all his movies with the scar down his eye.
Right.
Kicks him in the lock. He's like, YOLO is Carl Mewa. That's my godfather. So when I was three, instead of learning how to play catch, instead of learning football, instead of learning soccer, my godfather taught me what he knew. And it was how to fight and how to kick and how to punch. And then all these other martial, he taught sort of the Korean foundation that Taekwondo is built on today called Tung Sudo. And so that's what I learned first. And then I started to learn karate from, I'm telling you, my dad charmed a lot of people. So I've lived a privileged life. So I got to learn how to fight them from Chuck Norris.
Wow.
He taught me the wheel kick. Judo Jean LaBelle, the man who taught Ronda Rousey's mother judo, taught me how to choke people out. By choking me out in the third grade, my mom whacked him with a National Geographic. That's a magazine for those of you who are younger. And was like, he doesn't know how to tap. He's nine. And Gene's like, oh, sorry. Go do that to your friends. Get out of here. And so the guy, the original referee from the Karate Kid, Pat Johnson, the guy with the mustache, the Tom Selleck mustache.
Yeah,
and he's like, are you okay, LaRusso? That's the guy that taught me the roundhouse. Like, I just saw him in the mind. I was like, hey, that's Uncle Pet. We called them all uncles, right? Instead of masters. And my godfather's like, yeah, he's in the movies. And my godfather was the one who really got me into jiu-jitsu. That was when everything I started to want to learn, they really started to teach you. Because the submission game, I wrestled, and you're not allowed to really do submissions. It's about getting shoulders to a mat. The submission game, and the Brazilians describe it better than anyone in the world. They say jiu-jitsu is just a means to put your opponent in a position where they're more susceptible to negotiation. And when I heard the first guy say that, his name was Jean-Jacques Machado. He teaches here in Southern California. He teaches all over the world. I was 12, and I was a really good wrestler. And my godfather was like, oh, do you want to wrestle with Jean-Jacques? And I see this guy, and he's got one hand. One hand. He's really? Older than me. He's stronger than me, but I'm good. At 12 years old, like, I was winning like big time tournaments in all kinds of different forms. So I was like cocky and had my puberty going and just felt testosterone. And I'm like, yeah, I'll spar with this guy. He's got one hand.
It's like Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
I'm telling you, man, I'm looking at it. I'm not the Black Knight in this case. You know what I mean? So I'm looking at him. I'm like, I'm gonna do well. In less than 10 seconds, he had me in a fireman's carry, which is a wrestling hold where you're basically on their shoulders because you suck at wrestling. And I didn't. And he's spinning me around playfully saying, which window? Which window? Because we're on the second floor and he's pretending like he's going to throw me out a window, right? And so he puts me down and I have that Chris Tucker moment from Rush Hour where he's like, which one of y'all just kicked me? Right? Because it was like, I knew martial arts and all of a sudden I didn't. And this man started teaching me Brazilian jiu-jitsu, not Gracie jiu-jitsu, because they were the other family. And back then, they were sort of rival families. And this man tapped everyone out. He won the Abu Dhabi championship, not just in his weight class, but then again in the open weight class.
Wow.
With one hand. And so I was like, yeah, whatever your martial art is, that's what I want to do. And everything else sucks, even though it didn't. It's just that's what a 12-year-old brain says. So I was all in on that for a long time. And then I got into boxing after that in New Mexico from a great fighter named Johnny Tapia, who my godfather introduced me to. Johnny was not a good role model, but he was a role model.
What did that look like, not a good role model?
He was legally dead twice, took a lot of drugs, almost killed a few guys. He was a rough dude, and saw his mom get killed right in front of him when he was a young boy. Whoa. And just it wrecked him. But he was one of the best fighters in his weight class and will remain that way until the end of time. And my godfather knew him, and I was in New Mexico at the time with my mother when she was like in a better place and I was living with her again. And I started taking boxing at his camp there in New Mexico. And he would always say, don't be like me, just fight like me. To all the kids, don't be like me, just fight like me. So I fell in love with boxing. And then everything just kind of jumped on board after that. And I took as much as I could because I was a big proponent of Bruce Lee's books and his philosophies, because my godfather raised me on that instead of the Holy Bible or whatever, or the Green Bay Packers. I mean, he literally would go, team sports are... Can I curse?
Yeah.
He said, team sports are bullshit. They just teach you how to blame someone else when you lose. Now, there's something to that, but it's not that friggin' extreme. Like, there's great things about team sports, too. Like, if you ever want to work with someone besides yourself, which he's had a hard time doing his entire life, unless it's his wife who loves him. But so I was so invested in that, that I didn't really get into other sports until I got a lot older. But for me, it was all martial arts all the time. I still train. My kids train. I mean, I get to box with Wayne McCullough every week. He's a 3-time world champion, silver medal Olympian, going into the Hall of Fame. He's an absolute stud, and he teaches my freaking son.
Wow.
And, you know what I mean? So yeah. It's like, and I sit here, I go, he doesn't know how good he had it. I didn't know how good I had it until I got much, much older. And because of those relationships that he forged, because of the people who felt bad that they weren't able to save him, even though they didn't need to put that on their shoulders, they did. Mm-hmm. And they refused to let that happen to me. And so when I made the choice to do this, the only person who said no was my mom, and everyone else was like, don't worry, we got you. You're not going to screw up. You're not going to do that. And they didn't. Like, they stayed on me, kept me humble, physically beat me up just because that's how they know. And so those were the guys I grew up with, man. And because of that, I had some really cool relationships. And I love how many actors are into martial arts now and jiu-jitsu. And I, some of them, you know, are selling it more than practicing it. But there have been a few people who, if you get to roll with them, it'd be an honor. Like Paul Walker, rest in peace, was a legitimate black belt. Scott Kahn, who is still with us and awesome and sexy and cocky, is a legit black belt. Really? And will murk people. And so I love that actors have this sort of way to... Or any artist. I see musicians do it too. Demi Lovato was doing it as a means to kind of let other things out. Because that's what Bruce Lee used to preach. He would say martial arts is the physical expression of what we love and hate most about ourselves, but cannot say. And I've seen it work with children with autism, and I've had the pleasure of working with kids with autism and martial arts. Brian Ortega, who just fought for the lightweight championship and lost to Max Holloway, or featherweight championship, sorry. I saw him work with this boy. I will not get emotional, but this is like the most amazing story that I got to witness. This kid was non-communicative, okay? Could not speak. He could grunt. That's how severe his autism was. That's it. And Henner Gracie, who is sort of the figurehead of the Gracie Academy, who I was training with him and his brother at the time, and this Marine named Alex Stewart, who's a crazy black belt and a beautiful person. And they introduced me to Brian. And Henner sort of would always just throw Brian to the wolves because he's this special kind of athlete. And if you're familiar with his UFC career, you know that to be true if you've seen any of his fights. He's just a special, different cat. And he had no experience. He'd never worked with a kid with autism. He'd never worked with a kid. And he goes, hey, you need to, I won't say the boy's name. We'll call him Billy. You're going to work with Billy. And Brian didn't know what to do. And I've now met Billy, we'll call him, and I've heard this story. And so this is me telling what Brian told me. He said, I'm sitting in the small room with him. He won't talk. I don't know what to do. So I said, okay, lay down on your back. And he lays down on his back. And I got on top and I pinned him down. And I said, do you want me to get off of you? And he goes, ugh. And said, okay, so then do this. Put your left hand here. And the kid goes, ugh. Puts his hand there. He goes, put your other arm behind that elbow. Puts his other arm behind that elbow. He says, put your leg over my leg. He hooks his ankle over Brian's leg. He goes, now push up with the other one, push. Kid goes, ugh. And he flips Brian over, right? And gets on top of Brian. They do this for about 3 months. No speech. Hang on a second. No speech. And then they do the same drill again. And the kid flips him over and he screams, yeah! Wow. And Brian like goes, dude, I had to run out of the room because I was about to cry, which I'm about to do. And it was so what my godfather had beat into my brain as what martial arts can unlock for other human beings that... It was just like, whatever God you believe in, if you have that moment where someone gives you their testimonial, or if it's a philosophy that just clicks and you're like, son of a bitch, I knew I was right. I knew it. And it was that moment where I kind of had that explosion.
How did the kid come to him? Did the parents know to, did the kid, the kid's parents?
The father wanted his son to not get bullied, and he wanted him to take jiu-jitsu
because of
the
that.
Mom didn't want the son to learn to punch or kick. And they don't teach you to punch or kick in jiu-jitsu. They teach you how to block those, take the fight to the ground, or first control the distance, establish a clinch, take the fight to the ground, and then put your opponent in a position more susceptible to negotiation.
Because I have a friend that has two autistic children that are very much like that, and they're like 19, 18, 19
now. It's not always jiu-jitsu that might be the key. It could be kung fu. It could be boxing. It could be kickboxing. It could be wrestling. You know, there's so many different special instructors, and especially in Southern California, ever since the 1980s when Karate Kid blew up, every world-class martial arts instructor in the world moved here because they thought they could make more money, and they were right. And those men taught their students, and those students were men and women, and they started teaching students. We have, like, since I've been here, since I was born in Cedars-Sinai up the road, 1976. Since 1988, there have been multiple generations of masters and students who have become masters that teach all over the Southland, and not enough people take advantage. I have parents ask me at my kids' school all the time, where would you recommend? I'm like, you go anywhere. Like, there's bad schools, but there are, just look at the names. If it's a Machado school, if it's a Gracie school, you're gonna learn their techniques, and their techniques are tried and true, and people have stolen from them, and in a great way, because they've inspired new ways of thinking about protecting yourself, fighting. Kung Fu is a much more beautiful art. Well, I would argue Jiu-Jitsu is beautiful, but in UFC, Kung Fu isn't used, so you don't see it as such a brutal thing, right? And the Chinese, which isn't karate, the Chinese martial art, Kung Fu, is more about form and technique, whereas karate, the Japanese version, was more about streamlining attacks and not being as pretty. But some people respond more to the prettier arts like Taekwondo, and that's how they express themselves. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't act in a scene.
But you can't fight with Taekwondo, can you?
Yeah.
Really?
That, where do you think kicks come from?
It's just like very...
No, man. Those kicks are... Watch a Taekwondo tournament on YouTube. Bro, you'll see some knockouts.
Yeah.
I mean, where you're like, I can't watch that. That was brutal. Like, you'll see some knockouts. A lot of the guys performing so well in the UFC right now, Israel Adesanya is a Taekwondo world champion. He just happens to be really hard to get to the ground. But he's the interim champ right now.
So am I thinking of the right thing when you see like older folks
You're thinking Tai Chi.
Tai Chi.
Tai Chi is
now,
what
there's
I'm
also
of.
Yeah. There's also, hey, we have matching next card.
Yeah, we do.
oh, I feel so left out.
Yeah, yeah, hey, get yeah,
we
the
both
program.
We both went under the knife for our discs.
I know.
Tons of fun. But yeah, there's a battle form of Tai Chi called Qigong, which Eric Lee teaches, and he is local here in Southern California. Now, he also teaches a lot of Taekwondo and like a lot of weapons techniques. He taught me the chain technique, which they actually had me use in the first Scooby-Doo, but with a fire hose instead.
Really?
They had a Chinese wire team, and they were like, hey, we want to do this thing with the hose. We're going to get you a stunt gun. I was like, that's chain technique. And the guy was like, yeah, the translator. And I was like, man, I can do chain technique. I said, give me that hose. He goes, all right. And I started showing him what I could do and flipping it around and looping it on the foot and kicking it off. And the guy who didn't speak English, he just goes, blonde boy good. That's all he said. He called my wife blonde girl Sarah, and we weren't married then, and he called me blonde boy. He goes, blonde boy good. And I was like, oh shit, that guy worked with Jackie Chan. I was so hyped. But yeah, so that's me in that goofy Scooby movie, man.
So how do you, we've talked about your godfather.
He's the man. He's still with us. Dyes his hair. It's still brown, even though he's like 157 years old. He looks like an old Chinese warrior, but white.
Now, how do you feel about your father?
My pops?
Yes.
Post kids, much more at peace. So any junior can relate to this, right? Like if you're a junior, you don't really have your own identity for a long time. You're really just a statue built to honor that which walked before you. When you're a junior and your dad is the head of a company, that's a big deal because you're almost expected to follow those footsteps. When you're a junior and your dad is famous, you always have a shadow kind of looming over you. When you're a junior, your dad is famous and he's dead way too soon, and a lot of people feel like crap about it. You get pity when you don't want it. You get only the greatest stories, right? So I didn't have a three-dimensional picture of my father. I'm being dead serious with you, until I was about 30 years old. And that was because of Charles Fleischer, the stand-up comedian.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know Charlie.
And voice of Roger Rabbit. He used to open for my dad. Mm-hmm. And he would just tell me stories. Not, oh, your dad inspired me and was the nicest guy. Like, yo, I know, but did you know him? Can you tell me something? But nobody wants to say anything, right? Because they don't want to say, well, he did a lot of drugs. Like, nobody ever wants to say that, even when I was an adult. But Charlie never cared. And I remember one night, he goes, I was 15 years old. I was hanging out in the improv because my dad opened the, gave Bud the startup money for the one on Melrose out here. And he used to always let me sneak in the club. And he would, I won't say their names, but when I had to go to the bathroom, he would have to accompany me because all these big time actors in the 80s would be doing cocaine in there, right? And so he'd go in first. And then Paul won't mind that I said this. Paul Rodriguez and these two famous dudes, we'll call Joe and Jim, are in there, and everybody was doing cocaine. And he goes, I got little Freddy. Paul, get the bleep out of here. Or I can curse. Get the fuck out of here. Jim Bob, how are you? Little Freddy's here. And the other two guys are like, oh, hey, man. Okay, right on. Yeah, well, almost an impression. That would have been bad. And then I would go to the urinal and walk out. And this particular night, my mom was letting me stay with Charlie, who is a genius, but also crazy, and literally floats between that line. He has patents on art, on these things that artists use to like space the face so that the eyes and the nose and the mouth are right. And he patented this tool that does it basically for, like, he's crazy.
Well, he had that thing, Moleeds.
Yes, but that one is more spiritual than physical. Like, he showed me this thing. So I'm with him one night and he goes, Freddie, come here. I want to tell you a story about your dad. Okay. So we're in like, just like right outside where the stage is. And a lot of guys are smoking. And he goes, I was opening for your dad in Chicago. And he comes in the dressing room and he goes, hey, Charlie, do you think you have a bigger dick than me? And Charlie changes voices while he speaks to you. It's this crazy thing in his head where he'll just change accents in the middle of the conversation, whether he's on set or not. Like, it's just a tripped out thing. And it makes me do it sometimes because my mom let me live with him for a little while. So he goes, your dad says, do you think you have a bigger dick than me? And I go, yeah, probably. He goes, well, let me see it. And he goes, I wasn't gay. I didn't care. So whipped it out and he looks at it and he goes, nope, mine's bigger. And he walked out of the fucking room. And then that was kind of good night. And I was like, and so those are sort of the first interactions I had where someone was telling me the truth. So years later, I'm 30 years old and they wanted me to hire this really good British actor to play this recurring on my sitcom. And it was an important thing to me. I wrote it. I executive produced it. I starred in it. I dedicated it to my father. It was kind of when I let all that baggage go. And the chef that I wanted was Charles. Mm. And the other guy was more qualified for the role, more famous for the role. But Charles was my guy, right? So I hired Charlie. And he's like the angry chef who trained me. And now I'm the famous chef. So now he hates me. And like, that's his gimmick. And he did 3 episodes. And on the last one, he comes up to me in the dressing room. He goes, hey, Freddie, I wanna share something with you. And it's this like serious look on his face, which I rarely would see. So I'm almost a little scared. I think he's gonna tell me he has cancer or something, right? I'm like, that's usually the news I fucking get. So especially recently. But anyway, he goes, I wanna share something with you. He goes, everyone that I've ever worked with who was special to me, and he's holding this like drawing pad. He goes, I always have them draw me a picture. And so I'm like, oh my God, Mason had me draw a picture in this book that he's had since the fucking 70s, bro. And he goes, your dad drew me a picture in here. And right away I'm like, oh, I'm not going to get to draw in a book. But the rest of me keys in on dad. He goes, your dad drew me this picture. And I want you to have it. I want you to have it. It's important to me. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, I've never seen my dad draw anything, right? I've never seen a sketch that he's done nothing.
Right.
And he opens the book. And he tears it out, and it's like the paper's almost yellowed. He tears it off the spiral ring, and he turns it around. And it's like almost the whole, not the whole page, but like a third of the page is just this giant, erect penis with big balls and a tiny Jewish guy with a little Jewish afro creeping out the sides with his arms holding the penis. And it says, Dear Charlie... Stay hard, Freddie Prinz. And I was so prepared to see something else, like you guys are. Like, you want to laugh
I thought more. It was well, going to be... I thought it was going to be, you know, some beautiful piece of art. Yeah,
right. I want to know, was it circumcised? Was it actual Jewish
it
penis?
It was circumcised. I have it. I'll show it. I'll text a photo of it to you. I don't mind sharing that. I think I've even shared it on Twitter. It's like, this is my pops. So I'm in this weird place where I was expecting to see like a beautiful face, you know. maybe it's a picture of my mom. I don't know what to say. And then it's this dick, and he's looking at me like it's my mom's face, like it's something beautiful and special. And I'm like, wow, okay, he's not on the same, he's in the 70s right now, and I'm here, and he's not accepting the fact that I didn't have time to process this. So I'm just going all in, and like in an improv scenario, you commit to the moment, yep. You don't deny the moment. So I go, Charlie, thank you so much, man. And he gives me this hug, this awkward hug, and he walks away, and I go into my dressing room, and Brian Austin Green, who was on the show, is still my friend today, and I love him so much. He goes, what the fuck, you got a picture of a giant dick? And I just lost my shit, and it allowed me to laugh. And then I told him the story, and he's like, what the fuck? You did what? And it just blew both our minds that like that much history in this town that we all live in.
Sure.
And you just get these amazing moments that were induced by whatever, but they're still amazing moments. And I'm lucky, man. I've had so damn many.
At what age did you know that your dad was a big deal? Because he died, you know, like you were like less than a year old, right?
Yeah, by the time I was a first grader, kids would ask me questions, teachers would ask me questions. So then I started asking questions, but most of my family was not prepared to answer those questions. So I wasn't told the truth for a very long time. They were just trying to protect my feelings, but they said, you know, oh, he died of an overdose of prescription medication, was the story. Mm-hmm. Now, the first time a kid came up to me, I was a fifth grader, and was he A.J. Brown? Oh, you remember the basketball player A.J. Brownlett? A of U, played in the league for a couple years, won a championship.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was his little brother. Or no, he was younger than me. Maybe it was his older brother. It could have been his next door neighbor. I've tried to delete this memory. We were playing basketball in the street, and his team lost, this little punk ass kid. And he said, your dad shot himself in the head. He committed suicide. And I don't know why. I was a fifth grader, so I was like 10 years old. And I don't know why it felt more true to me than what I had been told, because I really didn't have any factual information. But something like just popped in my head. I don't even remember this kid's name. I think it was like Justin or something. And I was like, I don't remember how far he was, because he saw me come after him. And he started running. And when I caught that boy, I mean, I don't even remember but the last like 6 or 7 punches that I must have hit this kid with. I mean, he was crying and screaming, and my friend and his sister, I remember his sister crying and begging me to stop, and then my mom ran out and grabbed me, and then it was like this was the conversation she wasn't ready for, and so she sent me to California to meet the best man that I've ever known, who I have spoken to you about before. His name's Ron de Blasio. Mm. He was my father's manager. He was Richard Pryor's manager. Richard discovered my dad, by the way, and made Ron sign him. He repped George Lopez. He reps Fluffy now. And she had me come out here to California, and my Uncle Ron walked me around. I've told this story before. My Uncle Ron walked me around Brentwood, and we stopped in front of Marilyn Monroe's house. And he told me the story of Marilyn Monroe and just the life gone too soon and what this business can do to you when you're not ready for it. And when this business, you know, defines you and you lose your identity, how easy it is. And he said, most artists, and we've talked about this, this is why I've always been fascinated about Sigmund Freud, because this came from Freud, not my uncle. He said, most artists are beta personalities. They're very susceptible to compliments and criticism. He said, most people that want to express themselves are, because they want that, they need that, they want to share that. He said the alpha personality doesn't care. You can say they're terrible, they've already made their decision how they feel. You can say they're the greatest, if they don't like it, they've already decided how they feel. And he said your father was a beta personality, and he wanted to please everyone. I never heard the man say no once, and I worked with him for over 2 years. He took everything that was handed to him. He used every drug that was given to him. He had enough quaaludes in his system to kill a horse when in the autopsy. And he told me the truth, that there was no note.
And he told me his anger toward the media and in propagating that and in blaming my mother for it. It was ruled an accidental shooting in the courts.
What was the anger towards the media?
They blame my mom, and they created and wrote a fake suicide note.
Really?
Yeah. And they could never produce it because it was proof fake. But yeah, so they, my family hates the media. Like, my mom won't talk to a journalist if, I mean, she wouldn't, the saying is, I wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire. My mom would say it worse than that. Like, she don't play, man. Like, she did not like getting blamed for that. My dad, he was a genius, but he was a fuck up, okay? He cheated on my mom left and right. Pam Grier wrote about it in her book, okay? Like, they were in love. It's what drove Richard and my dad apart, because Richard was in love with Pam. Get this. So, Joanna Kearns told me this story, okay? The mom from Growing Pains, who was in a TV movie with my dad called The Million Dollar Ripoff. It's awful. Don't watch it unless you want something so bad it's good, right? I like movies like that. So, she tells me this, we're on a pilot that didn't get picked up. And I always know when my father slept with a woman that I'm meeting, because they say hi to me one of two ways. If they didn't date, it's, oh, hi. And if they did, it's, oh, hi. So I got the
last. Busted.
Right? I walk in the trailer and she goes, oh, hi. And so I know they've dated, right? And so I was sitting in the makeup chair next to her and I'm waiting for it. And I was older and much more okay with my father at this point. And she says, can I tell you a story about your father, please? And I'm like, yep, I know it's coming. And she goes, okay, it's kind of weird, but just bear with me. I go, no problem. She goes, all right, so he was on a date with me and Pam Grier. I go, hold on, what? Right away, she goes, well, he called me. I didn't know she was on the date, but I wasn't going to say no. So they're all at a restaurant on a date together. Such a stud. And
Richard, yeah, Pam Grier.
By the way,
I mean,
look,
Pam classiest, Grier. Most beautiful. I mean,
back then she was the one.
Yeah,
right, the one.
I just think Snake's got to dance.
Yo,
from Fort Apache, the Bronx.
Her whole look and identity has inspired not just this generation, so many generations with their look, their attitude, their style, and none of them give this woman credit. I shouldn't be talking so good about her. She helped my dad cheat on her, but I've forgiven, so we can speak, you know, more systematically about it. But anyway, they're on this date, and Richard was in love with Pam, and Richard discovered my father in a comedy club and told his manager, Ron de Blasio, yo, you got to sign this kid now. He's going to pop. And so he loved my pops, but he hated that Pam loved my dad. Like, she would be on the stage at Chico and the Man every taping, and they wouldn't let my mom come visit because they didn't want her to find out, right? And this goes back to my dad not being the best guy. So they're all on this date. Richard calls the restaurant, and he says, hey, I'm having a party over at my house. Y'all got to come over. So my dad's like, oh, yeah, cool. So he'll jump in his other car. And they're driving over there. And back then, Playboy used to do Playboy Radio. And a lot of comics would do sets on it. And my dad would practice a lot of jokes that, you know, just to flush them out. And he had a set that he hated. And Richard got it. And he had it at his house. And they all show up there. And there's no party. There's no one there. It's just Richard. And he starts playing the tape. And he's like, Pam, you think this unfunny motherfucker is sexier than me? What? And my dad starts getting pissed. And he's like, hey, man, you better turn that shit off right now. And Joanna's telling me the story, right? And he's like, fuck you, you unfunny. And my dad runs over. She goes, he knocked him out over the couch, grabbed the tape, took Pam, and left me. I said, what? Hey, what did you do? She goes, I got Richard a towel, and when he woke up, he called me a cab and said, bitch, get out of my house.
I thought the three of us were on a date.
So that was the end of that date. So anyway, the point was, you know, my dad fooled around a lot and wasn't a good dude and wasn't a safe father because he was taking so many drugs. And it wasn't until he came home high as a kite that my mom said, hell no, get out of here. You're done. We're filing for divorce. And that's it. And, they said that she pushed him away and drove him to drugs and like all this bullshit and never apologized, ever. Never took accountability for it. Even when they got busted, never, nothing, like no printed anything. So,
nope.
So my mom never will forgive them. Even if they did it now, she'd be like, fuck you.
She'd be like that dog.
There, you know?
That's so.
This is the first time that they actually interrupted the show.
It is the first time.
It's because the phone fell.
It's because the phone fell.
Yeah.
And Sophie thinks
everything's okay.
She heard a knock. It's all right, Soph.
How did your mother react when you told her you wanted to be an actor?
She said, hell no. Hell no. She said, you're going to go out there, they're going to chew you up, and they're going to spit you out. I said, Ma, I already spoke to Uncle Ron about this. He's going to look out for me. She can't speak bad about Ron because he was the one who told me the truth about my pops. So I led with that. I told her I'd stay in one of my godfather, Bob Wall's apartments, and I'd be there every weekend for dinner, and I was. I had to train karate for free. I didn't have a lot of money, so that worked out. But and I said, I gotta go. There's nothing. I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico with her. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be back home in LA where everything good and everything honest and everything bad happened, but at least I got balance. In New Mexico, everything was just bad. It just sucked, and it was not for me.
What sucked about it?
I just got in fights all the time. Like, I just, LA kids didn't care that my dad was famous. In Albuquerque, they did, and they wanted to fight, and I was just sick of it. Like, I'm not trying to like sound like a tough guy. I mean, it was every damn week I was getting in a fight. Like, it's just, it was ridiculous. Like, there's UFC fighters who shouldn't be fighting four times a year. You know what I mean? They should only be fighting three so their body can heal. I was fighting every single week. So I just wanted to leave. So as soon as I graduated, I didn't even attend my graduation ceremony. I didn't ever put on a cap and gown. I knew I graduated. LA was closer than New York. I knew what I was going to do. I was safer in LA. New York was nutso. I had family there, but they were only my dad's family, who will only say how great he is. Like, they can't deal with honesty and truth to this day. Although one of my cousins, I think Yvonne, is awesome, and her and I have started to grow closer as she's been able to say, he wasn't perfect. I'm like, that's all you had to say. So I went to LA, and I moved into this little apartment in Burbank across from the fire department on Screenland and Verdugo, right there.
Okay.
by Sal Palantonio's little Chicago,
yeah,
subs,
right,
place,
right.
Literally right behind it. And my godfather let me have a one bedroom there for free with no AC. And I realized why it was free. But I would literally go in my car, turn on the air conditioner in the summer, and sleep for 4 hours just so I wouldn't be sweating balls. Like, it was insane. I came to LA, and I just did acting class every single night. And when all those other guys were out partying, I was reading scripts, and I was watching like the auditions I couldn't get, and the guys I knew that were going out partying, I just go in and say I was them. And I got a role from Ryan Phillippe doing that. He's not mad at me. I got House of Yes because of that. I went in. I knew he was out. He was out with a bunch of people, and I was like, "That's a 10 a.m. appointment, man. That's mine." And I went in. I was like, "Signed, Ryan Phillippe." They called me in. It was Mark Waters was directing it, and Mary Verneau was the casting director. And I had already read for Mary as me. So I go in, and I see Mary, and I'm like, oh, shit. I check my shoes, right? Like, what this means, like, look away, avoid eye contact. And I just hear her go, are you ready? I go, yeah. And then she starts reading, and I start reading, and we stop. And Mark goes, man, that was really good. I want to give you another note, Ryan. And Mary laughs. And I get hot, right? Like, my ears turn like bright red. I got a lot of like humiliation going on right now, but I know I did a good job at the same time. So I go, uh-huh. And I'm just staying with it. And I'm hoping she's cool with the lie. And we do the second take, and I make the adjustments. And he wanted him to seem very sort of Norman Bates before he cracked. And I loved that movie, so I could pull that off. And I did it again, man. He goes, Ryan, that was really good. And she goes, okay, Freddie. And I'm checking my shoes again, right? I'm like, man, she's going to throw me out of here. She goes, that was a really good audition. I'll call Rick. That was my manager at the time. She goes, and we'll see what we can do. I was like, okay. And I left. And like 3 hours later, I got a call. And they're like, yo, you got the movie. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And when I talked to Mark, he was like, what the hell kind of hustle was that, man? I was like, dude, I love this script. I had read the play. I thought it was so good, man. I just really wanted, and you guys wouldn't meet with me. And he was like, well, you did a great job, man. He's like, I'm glad to have you in the movie. I hope that guy didn't get mad at you. I was like, I don't care. The next movie I booked was with Ryan. It was I Know You Did Last Summer. But we're good. We're good.
Were you a natural?
At what? Acting?
Acting.
No, bro. I hate seeing my early stuff. I hate seeing it. I always thought I was a better actor at the end of a job than when I started it. It was all on the job training for me. I didn't know how to really access real stuff until I turned about 28, 29 years old. And I have a lot of work before that where I was faking it. But sometimes you have to learn on the job. I didn't go to college. I was very guarded emotionally. So it was hard for me to allow directors I didn't trust to bring something out of me. Only I trusted me.
Right.
It was a very lonely experience.
So were you an alpha or a beta? Which are you?
Well, when I went to therapy, my therapist said I was an omega. So there's three major personality types. We're all three of them. All of us are all three.
Yeah.
But there's a dominant one. And my shrink said I was an omega. And the best way to figure this out is through the compliment and criticism. So you compliment an alpha and they're like, yeah, whatever. You criticize an alpha, yeah, whatever. That's Kobe Bryant. Like, that's question he's ever been asked, right? A beta is LeBron James. If you criticize him, he's like, well, then I'll be the bad guy you guys all need me to be. And he's very reactive to that. If you compliment him, he's very gracious and kind about it. The omega, they just want to know what you want. They're like, oh, you're the best ever. What does this guy want from me? They're much more, they want to remove themselves from the scenario.
Sounds a little cynical.
Suspicious.
Yeah. Suspicious. The shrink also said they're more long-term thinkers.
Right.
They're not as reactive. They pause before they speak. Like Mitch Kupchak would be a great example of an omega personality. This guy, when he was the general manager for the Lakers and would do interviews all over, they would ask him questions and you would hear guys think it was dead air. Because he would just wait so long before answering.
It always sounded like he was defusing a bomb. I've always said that. It sounds like Stephen John. And he's thinking.
Yeah. And there, it's always, okay, what's the end game on this? If I say this, it goes here. If I say this, it goes here. If I stay in the middle, that's not going to do. Like,
it's like red wire, green wire, yeah. Red wire, green wire.
And they consider all these thoughts as quickly as they can.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it very quickly. But a lot of actors who are omegas, like Vincent D'Onofrio is like the classic omega personality, right? Like he can decipher, you can see 20 things in a choice in a split second, right? Like Meryl Streep's the same way with her acting. Mm-hmm. Like she plays so many more levels. Till I was 28, I had two levels.
Okay, right.
I had A or B. D'Onofrio's A through Z.
Yeah, he is.
You know what I mean? Nowadays, I'd say I'm like A through M, right? But I'm never going to be at Z.
Yeah, you can kind of
see.
Just
some people born
to see stuff flicker through them.
And it's magic.
Yeah.
And you're actually, you know, a great actor, Peter Falk, said, it doesn't matter what you think about, so long as the audience registers thought. You can think about doing your laundry while you're executing your lines. They only recognize thought. They don't recognize what you're thinking. And I used to try that on this movie I did with him. And I'm like, I can't remember my lines if I'm thinking about laundry. Like, it just didn't click to me. But I was a 20-year-old actor.
Right.
And just didn't understand it. And then as I got older, I took a job working for the WWE and became their acting coach and writer. And I remember saying that to Shawn Michaels. He was asking me a question about a promo. I was like, brother, you can be thinking about laundry. The audience is just going to register thought. And he goes, man, that's fucking great. I go, that's Columbo.
It is.
Until you get a part where you work at a laundromat.
Yeah. Then it's organic. Relevant. Then it's organic and wonderful.
So how'd you meet Sarah?
We met on I Know You Did Last Summer, and we're just friends. I had a girlfriend at the time who I think was getting ready to break up with me for the third time. And I think she joined a cult this time around.
Hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's what happened. And good times. She was also in a relationship. So there was nothing between us. And she was as New York gets. And you know me well enough to know I am Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
As Los Angeles
all
gets.
LA.
I want to be at the beach right now. I can't because this boot. I want to surf every day. I can't because I'm weak and hate cold water. My wetsuit is so thick I can hardly paddle out sometimes. But I want to be out here. I'm chill. She's go, go, go. So we didn't even click that much except in a friendship way. And she couldn't drive. And where we were shooting in Southport, North Carolina, it was an hour to get to the gym. And she didn't have a ride. Nobody else wanted to work out but me. So I would put her in the car and we would just drive. And we were total, I'm telling you, total opposites. Like every
outlook she had on the world, I disagreed on. Like, everything. Like, she believed in our country, I didn't. She believed in the Constitution, I didn't. But I was raised, you know, my grandfather was like, look, the Constitution was written by rich white lawyers to protect rich white lawyers, not for people like you and me. You know what I mean?
So yeah, right.
That's what I was raised hearing, and I believed that. So we were complete and total opposites and just became friends because I thought she was too skinny, and I wanted, and I was a really good cook. And so after the movie, we started having these barbecues every week where her friends and my friends would all get together, and my cousin Joe and I would cook bomb food on the grill, and everybody would grow up. Her mom would come over, and we were friends for a good 3 or 4 years. And then we were going to go out. We had the same publicist. We were going to go out on like to Nobu in Malibu, the old one. And our publicist stood us up because she gets afraid to fly on airplanes. How does a publicist not want to fly?
Yeah.
She's still my publicist. I've been with her 20 years. I still give her shit about that. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, how do you hustle that?
It's like John Madden. You got to take a bus?
She's like, my people fly for me. I'm like, what the fuck? You started off as the people and you still haven't flown? It's crazy. Shout out to Leslie Sloan. I still love her. But she didn't show. And Sarah and I just went to the dinner. And it was still just, you know, just bros hanging out, drinking sake, eating sushi, having a good time. And then at the end of dinner, it was not bros. And she said, do you want to take a walk? And I was like, yeah, I do. And I knew right away. I was like, this just happened. Like, I'm going to fuck this whole thing up. We've been friends for a long time. And that's a wrap. But I had never had a relationship where I was friends first. So it just felt wrong.
Right.
And we started. This is not a bullshit story. We crossed the little underpass thing and got to this, like, grassy area that like looks over the water. It's already romantic, clear sky, moon is shining, no clouds, so it's crazy romantic. I shit you not, a dozen rabbits just go I'm like, what the fuck like it's a wrap, right? It's a wrap. So I just followed the signs and we kissed, and we've been dating ever since.
How long have you been married?
We've been married 16 years and together almost 18 years.
Does it ever hurt that you're both in show business?
Here's another great saying that I stole from my uncle. He, when I was going to marry Sarah, because I didn't believe in marriage. I didn't. Well, how could I? You know what I mean? So, and my uncle's marriage didn't even work out. So I proposed to Sarah, and my uncle's like, so he's got this great voice. So I read in the trades that you're getting married. It's like, yeah. He goes, are you prepared to be the setting? So what the fuck's that mean? He goes, the setting. Because he goes, when actors marry, one has to be the setting and the other has to be the diamond. Because if you both want to shine, it's never going to work.
Wow.
And I listened to that and was like, you son of a bitch. Like, I'm telling you, I had good, I said at the beginning of this, I've lived a very charmed life. I've had very good people who, with an active desire to teach, and I've always been a sponge with an active desire to learn. I don't enjoy passive education. I don't like facts coming at me. I'll be like, get the fuck, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in this month. I want to focus on this. And so he said that to me, and I was wanting to get married, so I was wanting to do it right. And I was already kind of looking for an out in this damn business already, and hadn't had it yet, hadn't found myself yet. And so I heard him say that, and that was when I came up with the idea to do the show Freddy, which was going to be like my last hurrah, right? Whether it was a hit or a miss. And it was going to sort of be this tribute to my father. I even used his, I reincorporated and took his name, Hunkerican, which was the name of his corporation, and even put that logo with his voice at the end of it when he would go, looking good, which NBC even took and had that as their whole network's motto in the 70s. That's how much of a G my dad was. But I did that as kind of my last thing. I was turning 30. I already outlived that son of a bitch, so I won, and I was still angry at him then. And that was going to be it. And when they canceled the show, it made it much, much easier to want to take a step back. And I took a few jobs because they pay you so great in this damn business. So I was like, shit, okay, it's 8 weeks, Toronto, right on. So I did that a couple times and just wasn't enjoying myself that much. And so finally I said, you know what? I'm going to do what I love. I have kids now. I want my kids to pursue the things they love. I want them to see parents that are happy with their jobs, not a dad who comes home from Canada and is like, oh, this fucking sucks.
So I started building Geekhead, my game channel.
Yeah.
And didn't think that people would want to watch me play video games and board games and all this. And we had a huge success on Twitch. And we're averaging like 220,000 and on the low end, 115,000.
That's crazy.
On our board games. These are just us playing a live board game that we kind of said, okay, well, let's reorganize all this and release it in a proper way because we were just winging it.
Explain Twitch to Sue.
Twitch is, it's like interactive television.
What am I, like the old lady here?
No, but it's interactive television.
Did I blank out or something?
I'm guessing you don't know what it is.
Well, I've heard of it,
but
I don't.
You know what Facebook Live is?
Yeah, yeah,
it's that, but instead of, you know, the person you're interested in watching and communicating with, instead of watching them just talk to you, you're watching this personality play a game that you've never seen or a board game that you like or a group of people. They also have talk shows on Twitch. They have wrestling on Twitch.
Right.
They have all kinds of stuff. So it's just another means of distribution. You have about 12 million active members, although I think that number's grown since the last time I've checked. But we had a lot of success there, so we sort of pulled everything in, found our cast, and then we leave like a bunch of slots open for stand-up comics and stuff because I think the best games are with people talking shit and telling jokes. And so all our board games are that. It's usually me and a bunch of comics or me and a bunch of actors that I think are funny. And we found our magic with a game called The Oregon Trail, which everyone remembers from their childhood is that computer game where you have to ford the river and you always die. And they did a card game of it that's a multiplayer cooperative group game. So the four of us right here, we could all play and we go five cards deep. And every time you go five cards is one round. 10 rounds, you make it all the way to Oregon. But there's all these challenges that come up. You might get bit by a snake. You might have dysentery. Mm-hmm. We might have to hunt for food. We might have a broken wagon wheel. And to solve these things, we have to get these cards. So the rules of the game aren't important. What is important is Macaulay Culkin is a son of a bitch. And he's my game nemesis. And ever since I beat his dumbass little brothers in Halo way back when,
right.
He's had it out for me. And instead of trying to beat me, he tries to outthink the son of a bitch who designed the game and hack rules somehow and is lucky I've never whipped his ass in real life. I love him, but I really hate him.
Does he have his own channel or is he on your channel?
No, this is just us in real life when we play board. We play a lot of games. So I've hated him for a long time, and he came on to the channel for the first time, and we were going to play Oregon Trail. And at the very beginning of the stream, I said, honestly, if it comes down to you and me, I'm not going to try to win. I'm just going to try to kill you. And he's like, well, it's Oregon Trail, so you can't. So fucking deal with it. I was like, all right, motherfucker. So we're playing the game, and sure as hell, stand-up comic Mary Lynn Rackstrup, from 24, she dies first. She was our only girl that stream. She's like, who's going to make the babies? Who's going to keep America going? She died. This amazing impressionist, Justin Ruppel, he got dysentery. We couldn't cure him. He died. My podcast partner, super awesome comic, Josh Wolf, he had malaria. Mac wouldn't give him medicine. He died. And it's just me and Mac. And we're at the river ford. And the rules of this card are, if I roll an even number, we successfully ford. If I roll an odd number, I have to pass the die. If I roll a one, it's a fail and I die. So I'm only praying for odd because I just want Mac to have to do the same thing.
Right.
And I tell him this, I go, I don't even want to afford that. I want you to die. And I so hope this is odd. Boom, five. It goes to Mac. And everyone at the table is like, oh, and Mac's like, fuck you. So now he has to roll. Even, good, odd, back to me, one, he's dead. I'm literally like in Caddyshack where they're like, miss it, Noonan. I'm like, fuck you, Mac, die. One. Three, it goes back to me. Now he's in my face talking trash. It's like when Larry Bird talked about the finals and he's like, no, I have to take that shot because if I make it, the pressure goes back on them and then they're tense when they come back up the court. That's how I'm feeling now. I'm feeling tense. So I'm looking at the die. I'm literally blowing in it like it's craps and I have a lot of money on the line instead of at the fucking Oregon Trail. I'm like, come on, odd. Bang, five. Fuck you. It goes back to Mac. He has the dice now. He's shaking his head. He rolls the die. He gets a one. it's the greatest gaming moment I had like that whole month, right? Just, and it was all a series of great moments. But to look at his character have to die and see the look of disgust in his eyes that I would kill him in a cooperative game. You cannot finish the game with one person. You just can't man the wagon train as one. So you can only go one more round. I had two to go. I didn't even take the next card. I was like, I don't care. I'm dying a happy man. Boom. And that was it. It was the end of the game. It's on YouTube. You can watch it if you want. But killing him is one of the most pleasurable things. And I think everyone has kind of a right. Like if you and John were in a game,
yeah.
I feel like you would try to kill
him. Oh, every game. Every game.
Did you do that at the poker thing?
Yeah. Every game is to the death.
You're like, raise it.
That's the way I grew
He's
up.
He's puffing, raise
it. But I mean, that's the way I grew up. My brother and I, every game
that's
is
how
to
games
the death.
Should be played.
Right. Yeah.
You should always play to win. And in this community that we live in, there's this whole like, let's make it fun for everyone thing. Yeah. And it sounds so incorrect to me, but I'm in the minority at my school, right? Like me and the PE coach are the only ones that are like, son of a bitch, this isn't gonna be good. But everyone else is all in. But when we play board games in my house, my son, we play Fireball Island. It's like an old school 80s classic game where you like are hunting for treasure. But if you get certain cards, you can drop these fireballs, which are just marbles. And it's a three-dimensional board game instead of just the flat ones. And so these marbles like roll down. And my son will be like, Dad, please don't do it. He'll be crying. I'll be like, you got to deal with that, bro. Boom, got him. And he'll be like, no. I'm like, and you can't quit. But that stuff's important, man. Like they didn't let me quit in karate when I, you know, I only want to do the karate that I was good at.
No crying in board games.
There's no, you can cry, but you can't quit. You can cry if you're little, but you can't quit. You can't quit.
But you'll drive him to cry, and that's okay.
That's, when he's six, he's going to cry.
Yeah, like,
he cries if he gets a wrong answer. We play another game called Mysterium, which is everyone helps everyone. Like, I'm the ghost. You guys are all paranormal psychics. You're in a house, and I need you to figure out who, it's like Clue, who died with what and in what room.
Right.
But I only have these like crazy, like abstract dream cards that have all this like wild looking beautiful artwork, like Victorian era artwork. And it'll have the similar images to the person, place, or thing. And I'm not allowed to speak. I can't give any clues. So I'm just like, ooh, and I hand you a card and you look at it and you're like, fucking rabbit holding a barbell? What the fuck is this? And you start looking and you're like, oh, there's a circle, and a line. And yo, it's in the fucking room. And then I can knock once if you're right and twice if you're wrong. And then you would have got it right. So then you move up. If my son gets it wrong, he's like, I got it wrong, Dad. I'm like, bro, it's okay. I'm not allowed to talk, but it's all right. You get to guess again. Don't worry. So it's good. You got to make them follow the rules and it's hard. But kids are what they are, man.
Does Sarah play?
Some games, yeah. She won't play like the RPG games. She's not into D&D. But if you bring out like Monopoly, Boggle, Othello, Stratego, like the old school stuff, she's all in. She did the commercial for the first Fireball Island in the 80s when she was like six. We have to have that game.
So you have a cooking book out.
I do.
How did cooking come into your life?
That's my mom. That's 100% my mom. That was her passion. That was her profession. Before my father, and she didn't teach me how to throw football. She taught me how to cook. So at an early age, you know, she was a late night eater. So I was a late night eater, and we would just sit by the stove, and all like the good memories come from that. Like I learned about World War II because of learning how to make miso soup. My mom was making miso soup from scratch in the 80s. I said, what's miso? She goes, well, that comes from Japan. And I said, Japan. I said, didn't Papa, my grandpa, I called him Papa. I said, didn't Papa go to Japan? And she said, no, they attacked where he was. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, he was on a boat called the USS Nevada. And it was one of two boats that escaped the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I said, what's that? And then she started breaking down what all that was to me. And I was still a young kid. And when my grandfather and grandmother came to move with us, I asked him about that story. I said, yo, you were on the one boat. Like, what was that like being in the war? And he goes, Freddie, I'll tell you the truth. He said, I was in the lower deck in the engine. He was an engineer, a mechanic. And he said, I was on the lower deck. We heard the explosions. My superior officer came down and said, just keep the engines running. He said, Freddie, I never saw the war, but I heard every bomb drop. And they hauled ass and got to safe ground. And I think one other boat did. I could be wrong on that. But yeah, I learned that by sitting in front of a stovetop with my mom, learning how to make miso soup, chopping scallions.
What's your signature dish?
I feel like when people answer that, it's because they can only cook like four or five things, and I can cook everything, and I can do a really good job at everything. Mm. So I do steaks great. I even get people that like steaks well done and put ketchup on them to try it my way, and they say, damn, bro, that's good. And that's Dulé Hill. Just busted you eating jerky with ketchup. Good Lord. Good Lord. How are you going to put ketchup? Listen, this is for Dulé. Clip this and send it to him on Twitter.
Yeah.
You said a lot of bad things about me a lot of years ago on Monday Night Raw, right? And I know you were just joking, but let me tell you something right now. I want everyone to know this man burns his steaks and doesn't put A1 on it, puts ketchup on it, and then spits on his own food to ensure you won't try to eat it. Like any other human being on earth would want to eat your shitty, tough ketchup and mustard steak. Well, you don't have to spit on that, bro. So deal with that truth. I don't know where I was, what I was talking about, but anyway, I had to get that off my chest.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did.
I love Dulé. He was at my wedding.
So Freddie, when after Enzo died, I called Freddie and I was devastated.
We just lost ours too.
Did you?
Yeah, I know. I'm literally going through the exact feelings you went through that we talked about.
What happened?
She got cancer, man. Mm. She was only 6 years old. Oh, can you believe that?
No.
I've been through it too, but she's the dog was older.
It was a purebred, and I guess when they're that, when they're sort of genetically purebred dogs, they're more susceptible to it.
Yep.
And man, like, oh,
it's the toughest. It's the hardest thing in the world to go through.
Yeah.
That's what did awful. We say? Didn't we say something like, no matter how many times it happens, it hurts exactly the same amount, or something like that?
Yep. No, it's brutal. I've lost two now. Yeah, but that was the worst.
Yeah, I got a text from you. I was in Florida, and you text me.
That's right, because you had just met Enzo.
That's right.
Yeah.
Dogs are the best, man.
They're the best.
I'm not anti-cat, but dogs are way cooler than cats.
Oh, yeah. Way
cats
cooler.
Don't care when you come home.
No, I don't understand cat people at all. I never have. I never have.
You know what it is? The only cats I like are the ones that are like dogs.
Yeah.
Although my last dog was kind of like a cat.
And there are some that are like that. I had a friend who had a cat that you could, that the cat would fetch.
Yeah.
And the cat would come when you called it. Which is kind of a rarity.
Yeah, you have to have something shiny usually to make him do anything. Whereas a dog, you just go, hey. And they're like, let's do it. I don't know what we're going to do, but let's go.
I went to a 4th of July party the other day, and this guy had a border collie mix.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog plays catch.
Oh, that's
really? You throw a rubber ball, a big rubber ball, and it goes like that with its snout, and it goes up in the air, and you catch it, and then you throw, and you just
air bud, man,
and it just keeps on doing it.
Wow,
yo! When I was a kid, we used to go to there used to be a park by Pierce College, and there was a lady out there, and she had a Dalmatian, and she had these blocks that had like raised numbers on them, 1 through 8 on each side. It was like a barbell, and then a little part in the middle for the dog to bite. She would call out numbers, and a dog would go get the right number and bring it back to her. It was a Dalmatian. I'd never seen anything like it.
Okay.
We had just done this, like, my godfather took us to this like celebrity go-kart thing where Lou Ferrigno flipped the go-kart, stuck out a big ass arm, flipped it back over, and beat Mary Lou Henner at the end anyway. It was like 1986, and we were at this park. I'm telling you, dude, this is real shit, man. Have Lou Ferrigno on your podcast. Ask him if that's a true story. And we went to the park, and this lady's dog would fetch number and wasn't wrong. It's not like it was guessing. It would go up to him and like nose him and eye him. And I'm just a kid, but we were like, yo, can we say 1? 7. 7. Be like, yo, I don't know
kids,
dogs could
kids
do
who can't do that.
For real.
Well, Freddie.
Si, senor.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Is that it?
It was awesome. Yeah.
How long is your podcast? Just an hour?
I don't know. How long is the podcast? 1 hour? Yeah, an hour today.
You're just lucky because I talk so much.
You do talk, man. You're a storyteller. I love that.
But when I'm on your show, I don't talk too much.
No, you don't.
See?
So is this a big surprise to you that he talks so much?
No, I always knew it was there.
I knew it was there.
But now he had the forum to do it.
Yeah, no.
In an environment.
No,
commercial breaks.
Yeah, that's right. No, I always knew it could go.
I suck with commercial breaks. That's what it is. That's why I'll never make it on radio.
No, you're great on radio.
Oh, thanks.
And great on Twitch. You got to watch Twitch.
So. Well, I will now.
Do you understand what it is now?
I do.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
I tell a ton of stories on there more than I play games. Like, I'll play golf and just because it's easy and boring, and I'll just tell Richard Pryor stories. Like, all the times that I got to meet him and how much shit he would talk. I was like 13 years old, the first time I ever got to meet him. Sorry, I'll finish with this. And I told this on Twitch, though. That's why you should watch. And it's Geghead, G-E-G-G-H-E-A-D, Geghead on Twitch or YouTube. And he was already not sick, but not feeling great, right? It was the first time I got to meet him. And he goes, "Your father was a motherfucker, but he was a funny motherfucker." And I was like, "What? What?" Like, he's my favorite comic ever.
Yeah.
And I wanted to punch him in the face. You know, I was like, "What?" And my uncle's like, "I warned you." But I didn't know the Pam Grier stuff back then.
Awesome, man.
All right, cool, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks for doing it.
It's just 15, 20 minute drive. Whenever your next guest falls out, just call me.
Cool, man.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.